From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, the Cosmic Internet with Frank DeMarco. Get ready for that. We're also monitoring the return of the space shuttle Endeavour. Richard C. Hoagland standing by. Should land in about an hour or so. Richard will come on the program, our science advisor, and tell us how things are going. My, oh, my, oh, my, what's happening to our planet? Listen to this story. Now, this happened over the Memorial Weekend. U.S. Park Police arrested five people at the Jefferson Memorial. What was their offense? What did they do wrong? They were dancing. The dancers were protesting an appeals court ruling handed down last week that the national monuments are places for reflection and contemplation, and that dancing distracted from such an experience. Now, back a couple of years ago, Mary Brooke Oberwetter and a group of friends went to the Jefferson to commemorate the president's 265th birthday by dancing silently while listening to music on headphones. Park police ordered the revelers to disperse, arrested them when they did not. She sued on free speech grounds. An appeals court ruled last week that her conduct was indeed prohibited because it stands out as a type of performance, which you're apparently not allowed to do there. So these five people were arrested. Two of them were, they were kissing each other like couples. Nothing really bad, not in public. There was no profanity out there. There was nothing. And they were slamming them on the ground. They were cuffing them. Something's wrong here. You know, as we've been reporting, and now a respected international panel of scientists says that cell phones are possible cancer-causing agents, putting them in the same category as the pesticide DDT, the gasoline engine exhaust, and they say coffee. The classification was issued in France by the International Agency for Research on Cancer after a review of dozens of published studies. The agency is an arm of the World Health Organization, and its assessment now goes to the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the national health agencies for possible guidance on cell phone use, classifying the agents as possibly carcinogenic. It said doesn't mean they automatically cause cancer, but people shouldn't change their cell phone habits. But we just don't know. And Louise Gittleman, of course, doctor, she's with us. What do we do? I'm confused.
Well, join the group there, George. But you know, I'll tell you something. The fact that finally a very august international organization has said that cell phones are possibly carcinogenic should make us a little bit cautionary in terms of our use of this very, very popular device. And so I think it's not really adults that have to watch out, but it's truly children and teenagers, because there has been some very compelling evidence that was conducted a couple of years ago by a Swedish oncologist that found that children and teenagers are five times more likely to get a certain kind of brain cancer if they begin using cell phones before the age of 20. So I think it's really this upcoming generation that we have to be a little bit more concerned about. And certainly there are lots of tips that we can start to integrate into our lifestyle so that we can be safe rather than sorry if we find out years down the line that these are actually very cancer-causing, similar to tobacco smoke or asbestos or even tanning beds.
Good point, Ann. And, of course, the only good thing about young people with cell phones, most of them text. They don't talk on the phone as much as adults used to.
Exactly. And that's where I find texting is so much better than talking, and that you really need to go offline as much as possible, put people on speaker as much as you can. You really want to keep that cell phone as far away from your head as possible so that you reduce the energy or power level, because the farther you're away from that antenna, the lower the pulsating signal. It's not really the intensity of the signal. It's the fact that it's so unusual and completely abnormal to the way your brain and your heart function, which are, after all, electrical organs.
Okay, thank you, Ann, very much. The foodborne bacterial outbreak that has hit Germany and other European nations is unlike anything Western experts have seen. So far, 16 people are dead. more than 1,000 sick, including nearly 400 suffering severe and potentially fatal symptoms. But several days into the health threat, scientists remain unsure what produce in what country is responsible. They think maybe contaminated cucumbers, maybe from Spain, but they're just not sure. Investigators across Europe were frantically trying to determine the scope of the contamination by what they call a very unusual strain of the common E. coli germ. I hope somebody's not manipulating with that. And as we've been reporting, of course, the space shuttle Endeavour scheduled to touch down in about an hour or so. We'll tune in to Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, when that happens tonight. The tough task of guessing what hurricane season will look like could be even more difficult this year for forecasters who won't be able to rely on the relatively predictable forces known as El Niño and La Niña. So far, the National Hurricane Center in Miami is predicting that the season that begins on Wednesday will be busier than normal, with as many as 18 named tropical storms. 3 to 6 of them, they say, will be major hurricanes. Now, in a moment, Whitley Strieber joins us. We'll talk about the weather in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this year starting out as one of the worst weather years I've seen in a long, long time, and we know about all the tragedies we've had with the tornadoes recently. Whitley Strieber, author of many best-selling books, novels, also his internet radio program, Dreamland, his website, unknowncountry.com, very popular science website, and here he is on Coast to Coast with his expertise on what the heck might be going on. Whitley, what is happening?
Well, what's been happening is that the summer started early in the southeast and is ending late in the northwest. And that creates a problem because there's a terrific imbalance, or has been, between cold air coming down from the northwest and warm air pouring up off the Gulf of Mexico across the southeast parts of the Midwest and into the mid-Atlantic states. And you get something like that, and you're going to have an explosive situation. And this year, it has been just exceptionally powerful. Now, right now, the jet stream, which has been moving much farther to the south than normal, has begun to move northward. So the southeastern and central United States and mid-Atlantic states, what they can expect now is hot, humid weather, but not necessarily any more than localized thunderstorms, none of these big supercells, unless a cold front coming in from the West Coast, from the Pacific Northwest, should push the jet stream back down again and repeat this. Actually, we wouldn't expect to see it occur again until the fall, and if last summer is any indication, and what's happened so far this summer is any indication, what we might be seeing is a very dangerous situation developing again around September, October, because that air coming up from the Gulf Stream is going to be very, very hot at that point. And if the Pacific Northwest cold fronts are as aggressive in the fall as they have been in the spring, it's going to be explosive again.
Yeah, we could have one of those treacherous years this year, Whitley. Yeah. And, you know, I don't know if we can sustain much more of this. What do you think?
Well, we're going to. We are in a we're in a very complicated situation. Big picture, the climate is changing. It is
drastically.
Well, eventually it will be drastic. Yes, the scenario for climate change is setting up. If you look at a picture of the Gulf Stream, the way it is, the flow of the Gulf Stream, which is created. In a schematic that's available on the internet from a scientific organization now, and what it was like, say, in 2004 on the same day, the difference is really startling. You can't see the eastern half of it. It's gone. It's still flowing, but it's flowing so weakly that it's now completely below the surface. Whereas in 2003, 2001, 2004, it visible across the whole North Atlantic. Now, that's happening. The other thing that's happening is north of there in the Arctic Ocean last summer, there was a great deal of melt in polar melt in mm-hmm. In the North Polar Cap, and a lot more melt of glaciers in Greenland than anyone expected or even dreamed possible. The result is there's a big bolus of fresh water in the Arctic Ocean that's hanging there. Now, if there's another ultra-warm Arctic summer, then that's going to get big enough to begin to move south, and when it does, the Gulf Stream will stop entirely. Because the temperature differential, I won't go into the explanation of why it will happen, but trust me, it will. And there's another thing taking place, and that is, I'll give you an example of it. Last September, Russian scientists observing the Siberian tundra via satellites noticed that a lot of the lakes that were just beginning to freeze over appeared to have large bubbles under the ice.
Bubbles?
Bubbles hanging under the ice, trapped under the ice, gas of some sort. They thought they knew what it was, and it was pretty scary, so they got out there. And even before they had the instruments that were following them had been bought to test exactly what this gas was. One of them broke the surface and pushed down on the ice, forcing some of the gas out from under the surface, and he found he could light it with a match. It was methane bubbling up in massive quantities.
That's not a good sign.
No. Methane is the most powerful greenhouse gas there is. It's something like 30 times more powerful. I could be wrong about that number.
And you know what? There are no plants in Siberia. There are no cars up there in Siberia.
What's in the tundra.
That's right.
And it's under the ocean. There are vast frozen methane hydrates under the Arctic Ocean. But they don't freeze at the same temperature ice does. They freeze at about 48 degrees, and that water is just hanging just above that temperature right now. And if it should drop below and those methane hydrates will release their methane, then we're going to have a situation very similar to the situation that develops before climate change takes place, the situation Art and I outlined in Superstorm and that was repeated in The Day After Tomorrow. And, you know, we were laughed at on the Today Show by Matt Lauer. But a few years later, scientists in Germany analyzing cores from ancient lakes in northern Germany found that the climate had changed completely at the beginning of a period called the Younger Dryas about 14,000 years ago. In just 30 days.
I bet they wouldn't be laughing today, Whitley.
I don't know about Matt Lauer. He'd probably still be laughing because I'm quite sure this is going to surprise him a lot if it happens, God forbid, during his lifetime. But the scientists aren't laughing anymore, no. It can happen very quickly. And, you know, we can sort of see the power of the weather. Like, I go on the internet and I see all these things saying, oh, it's all being done by HARP, by that government.
Right, being manipulated,
it cites the ionosphere. And I think to myself, gosh, they don't really understand at all what's going on. Because they think that weather systems function like fires. In other words, you just need a little match and you can set the whole thing on fire. But that's not how they work. You got to move a whole lot of air and keep it moving. It doesn't move itself. So you need absolutely extraordinary amounts of energy to do these things. The energy that was expended by those storms that have done so much damage across the southeast this spring is almost unimaginable. It's far more energy than can be expended by the whole United States in a matter of years. It's not if you could have some kind of an instrument that could cause weather like that to happen, we would have to have gigantic power stations doing it. It's not possible. It just isn't possible. So It is a climactic issue. It is not a. It is not something being done by somebody nefarious. Indirectly, it is being done by us because the emissions of human emissions of carbon dioxide are bound to have sped the process up. But it is a process that has repeated, I think, as much as 12 times in the past 3 million years. We're going to live through it. Most of us, actually, are going to see this change. At some point in our lives.
What about our kids or their kids, Woodley? Do they get the brunt of this?
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
They do, and, you know, what I have been saying for years, what Art said when he was active in this, exactly the same thing. We need to accept the fact that this will happen eventually, no matter what we do, do everything we can to lessen its impact and plan for it intelligently. We've done none of those things.
No.
And then there's no sign. There's still time to do them. We could figure this out. We could plan for it. Instead of going through this ridiculous political debate, I mean, nature doesn't care about our politics.
No.
Nature doesn't care. Praying isn't going to help. Nature is number. 2 and 2 equals 4 in nature. Never 3.5, no matter what we do. So we got to just face this. Our civilization can come through this intact, but it's going to be hard. It's going to take cooperation, planning, intelligent foresight. It's going to take just about everything we've got to survive.
When you wrote The Key, which is out now, right?
Yeah, The Key is out in a new edition right now. You can get it at Amazon or anywhere.
This individual who entered your room, did he tell you things about the future?
Oh, yeah.
And things we should be very cautious about?
He was the smartest man I ever met. And I say that now with complete authority, because the book's sitting there. It was first published in my personal edition in 2001, in print. It wasn't an online thing, so the print copies are out there, and those print copies have in them scientific predictions that at the time seemed completely off the wall, which have later turned out to be true. He said there was more than one universe at a time when that was just laughable.
Right. Nobody was talking about multiverses then.
No, but now, not only are they talking about parallel universes, but they're talking about other universes as big as our own out there somewhere, and they're saying, and this is one of the most incredible, extraordinary, awesome things I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, they are, Woody. I mean, I'm having a difficult time trying to comprehend it.
They're saying, astrophysicists are saying that the background radiation in our universe shows that it has come and it is collided with another or other universes at least 4 times in its vast history.
Hence maybe the Big Bang.
Well, there's been more than one Big Bang.
Right.
That's the incredible thing. Yes, our universe was probably created by the Big Bang, but other Big Bangs created other universes out there somewhere. And he knew that back in 1998, but it was total heresy. And that's not the only thing. He was the one I pieced together after I talked to him.
Did you think he was nuts then?
No, I didn't. At first I thought he was, you know, an intruder. I mean, somebody, you know as well as I do, and I don't think this will surprise any of our upfront listeners, nobody wants to see a fan after midnight. No fan who's going to show up after midnight is going to have good ideas.
Not knocking on your bedroom door.
Especially coming into your hotel room.
Right.
Because it implies all kinds of things have been done. He's found you. He's arrived in the middle of the night.
Uh-huh.
You're going to be unhappy very soon.
Yeah.
And that was my thinking as he came into the room and started talking. But he was so interesting that it actually worked. You know, I started to throw him out, but then I didn't. And he was just a little man. I mean, he was, you know, I could have taken him, and I'm no fighter.
See, somehow, though.
Thank him, and he sure didn't have a gun.
Somehow you calmed down on this, though, because.
Well, I calmed down on him because he was so interesting, and he was saying things. And the other thing is.
Hold on for a second, Whitley. We're at the bottom here. and we're going to take this quick break. I'm George Norrie. Of course, this is Coast to Coast AM. Whitley Strieber with us as we talk about weather changing patterns and also some strange things that happened to him a long time ago when he wrote The Key. I'll be back. Well, next hour, Frank DeMarco joins us as we talk about the cosmic internet, explanations from the other side. When we come back, we'll take phone calls with Whitley Strieber and continue talking about this very strange man who went into his room years ago and told him about all kinds of things. Whitley's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Whitley Strieber with us. Whitley, I was thinking today about just how precious the moment is. And by that, I mean, you know, here we are a little over a week ago, people in Joplin, Missouri, enjoying the time of their day with their family and friends. All of a sudden, some of them get killed by a tornado. Here people are in Germany eating cucumbers, for crying out loud, they think.
And
they die. 16 people die. I mean, when it happens, it happens.
It happens. When I was a little boy, I was in one of those tornadoes, 1953 tornadoes. That was the last really huge outbreak in this country. And I remember the helplessness. And of course, I was about 8 or 9 years old, so I didn't really fully understand it until I was in a hotel room and my father had gone to a business meeting. He'd taken me up to Waco, Texas with him. And when he rushed into that room, I'll never forget the look on his face, the fear and the shock, helpless terror that went through me. And I realized that the darkness outside and all the banging was really something very dangerous.
Well, it's the one thing that we humans can't truly control. Now, we talk about weather manipulation, and I know it's being done. I mean, we've seen the experiments, but, I mean, you really can't stop it.
No, it's done on a very small scale, and the reason is the scale is always small is that air is not like – it's not combustible. It's not like forests, for example. You can start a gigantic forest fire with a single match because each leaf that burns sets other leaves on fire. But with wind, with air, you have to push it. And in order for it to get it to do anything, you have to keep pushing it. And if you stop pushing it, it stops moving immediately. And you can't cause it to push itself. But nature being nature, nature has the means to push it real hard. We don't. We can do things like we can seed clouds, and that's somewhat effective sometimes. But we don't have any mysterious scalar weapons that can manipulate the atmosphere because we don't possess control over enough energy to do that.
When this individual knocked on your door back there in, what was it, 1998?
Right.
When he knocked on your door and came in, what did he first say to you?
We're chained to the ground. You're chained to the ground, rather. And I thought, that was while I was trying to remember.
It was in the wee hours, right?
Yeah, it was. Well, I thought it was about 11, but it turned out to be around 3. I thought he was the room service waiter coming into, and instead he started talking and he ignored the tray and went over to the other side of the room and sort of got as far away from the door as he could and started talking. And the first couple of things he said, you know, that's interesting. And, you know, started kind of trying to get him out of there and thinking about maybe calling downstairs or pushing him out. And then he really started launching into some very interesting stuff. In a few minutes, I found that he was talking about the weather and about climate change and about ice ages. And it was so fascinating and so unusual. And the other thing about him is you asked him a question that he didn't even take a breath. His answer was instant. Like you'd ask him a question, what's such and such? And it would go like this. Well, what's such and such? Well, such and such is so. And, you know, there was never any, it was weird. It was almost like talking to yourself, but it was a real person.
How did he eventually leave?
I'm not sure. That was one of the things that made me think the next day that it was one of these weird experiences. And, you know, people forget that I came to this as a total skeptic. I went through a lot of it when I was a little boy. But I had forgotten that. It was all child stuff. I put it aside, completely forgot it. If you had asked me in June of 1985 whether or not aliens were here on Earth, I would have just laughed.
Let alone visiting you.
Let alone have anything to do with me.
Yeah.
Exactly. So the result was the next morning when I realized that I hadn't asked him his name. I didn't know who he was. I didn't have a phone number. He'd left, and I woke up the next morning without any real clear idea of what had happened. I thought, oh, this is one of those experiences, because I do remember taking notes, and they were lying there on the floor, some scribbled notes. And so this happened. So I called my wife. She was down in Texas, and this was in Toronto, and I said, don't ever let me say this never happened. So by the time I got to Texas that afternoon, I was saying, it never happened.
Yeah.
And that went on for a couple of years while I sort of, with one hand, tried to find him and did a little investigation here and there, trying to figure out who he was, and kept telling myself, you know, you ought to really write this all down before you forget it. And finally, in the year 2000, I decided I'd put a book together, and I did that. But it didn't work really, and you know, I was trying to a nonfiction book based on the things he'd said. And I finally faced the fact the only thing that'll make this work is if I put this down verbatim, and that's where I started working on it.
Did you finally conclude who he was or what his mission might have been?
No, I never did. Never got anywhere with that. But I took the climate change thing really far. I mean, Bart and I wrote Superstorm based on his ideas, and he didn't really, you know, he put it together very succinctly, very clearly, and then I had to go into scientific papers and look here and there
for backup, I guess, right?
Well, no one had ever put it all together, but it was all there already in science. You could find it. It wasn't like some of the things he said, but this, you could find it if you looked, and you put this paper together with that paper, and you realize, well, these people together, collectively, are saying the same thing he said, that when this thing pops, it pops a big time, and it's something to be really concerned about. And so, you know, then the book came out, and we toured all over for it, and then Roland Emmerich bought the rights, and it became a huge movie, and
it was
effective. And then, of course, the same scientists who had written some of those papers started rushing around saying, it couldn't happen that fast, it couldn't happen that fast, when they knew different. And they do know different now. And now the superstorm scenario is kind of an accepted
fast reality
in science.
Brutally. Let's take some calls here with you, Whitley. Let's go to Lincoln, Nebraska. Brian's with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Brian.
Hi. George, I'd love to first off say thank you so much for sticking up for callers like me. I am an abductee. The question I have for Whitley is in regards to he wrote that book, Hybrids. I haven't had a moment to read it yet, but I've got something like the little man he described. I'd heard the night they had him on talking about the book, he's a little man perched on the corner of my neighbor's roof, and one other thing that I wanted to ask about. I have this strange impression, this feeling, and I've had it persisting for almost my entire life, that I can feel as though I'm able to influence the weather, namely the wind and rain.
Can people do that, Whitley?
Well, I can influence the weather very simply. Just put me in New York City without an umbrella, and you're going to get rain.
That's right.
But the man, that's a very weird story he's telling. And, you know, things have changed. In the days I had that guy in my life, there were various bits of debris left around. I could have done DNA studies on them if that had been available then, but it wasn't. It is now. So if the guy leaves anything behind, for God's sakes, pick it up carefully, seal it in some kind of baggie, plastic, anything, seal it in anything so it doesn't get touched, and send it to me, to my address in Texas. It's all over my website and unknowncountry.com. Send it to me, and we'll get it DNA tested. That would be great.
The individual in the key, would you like to see him again?
Oh, yeah. I've got a few questions for
you. You have questions now, don't
I
you?
I do. When I couldn't find him, and finally I thought, well, you know, I'll put the book out on the website. I'm not going to make a big deal of it because I don't think it, you know, it's got too many crazy things in it, like this Newtonic idea that gas, some kind of gas, I think he said it was nitrous oxide, can hold memory that can be used in a super dense computer memory. I thought it sounded like something out of a 50s Buck Rogers movie. So I just published it kind of quietly on the website in hopes that it would bring him out, you know, that he would come out.
Who might this little man be up there on the roof that Brian's talking about?
Well, I don't know. I had back in 1993 and into 94 at our cabin in upstate New York, we had such a person who lived behind the house in the woods and was small, and when I first saw him, I thought he was a child. But I walked up to him. He was back in the woods smoking a cigarette, and it was very, very dry. It was August. I guess it was August of 1993.
That freaked you out, didn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, an 11-year-old child smoking in your woods when you've got these pitch pines just 50 feet or 100 feet away from him that could be set on fire just by thinking about it. Yeah, I was very concerned. So I walked up to the guy, and as I got closer to him, it was obvious that he was not a child, that there was something else going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to skedaddle because I was not comfortable. I was about a good mile back in the woods, half a mile anyway, certainly, or between a half a mile and a mile, and alone with this strange being, and I'd had plenty of weird stuff happened to me by then, and I decided to return to the house immediately and quickly, and I did that. And subsequently, he hung around there a lot, and then we moved to Texas, and we were in a little condo. It had a screen porch. It was at the street level, and there's a little corner there where he used to hang out beside our bedroom in this little cul-de-sac. And damned if I didn't discover that people were noticing him, and they called Texas State Social Services because they felt like there was this feral child wandering around in the place when he should be in school.
Strange.
And one guy saw him jump off of a balcony into the swimming pool fully dressed. It was stuff like that happening. And, you know, finally I put a motion-sensitive light in the cul-de-sac. We found the apartment behind us, he and two men were living in. We called the owner of the apartment, who lived in Houston, who said, there's nobody living there. I use that when I come up for business. He said, I'm sorry, but you've got tenants. Then, a couple days later, the sheriff shows up to evict him, and they get an eviction notice, and they go around the building trying to sell a guy's furniture as if the rest of us didn't know what was going on.
Jeez.
It was insane. Then the last time I ever saw that little guy, he suddenly burst out around the side of the building while I was out in the little garden gardening and went marching off down the middle of the street, and I've never seen him again.
Never saw him again.
How
strange.
He was quite real and quite strange, and he was there. And that's the end of the story. I can't tell anymore because I don't know anymore.
Tulsa, Oklahoma. Sharon, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wanting to ask Whitney about, I live in Oklahoma, as I said, and it's like I've been in four major tornadoes here.
You're in Tornado Alley, Sharon.
Yeah, I was born here. But I was wondering, to me, it seems like they stay on the ground so long now. If before, they used to seem like they would dip, you know, a bomb
mm-hmm.
or two.
Pop down, pop back up again. Yeah.
Right. And now it's like miles.
And what keeps them on the ground like that?
Well, what keeps them going is that the conditions that created them in the first place are lasting a lot longer because there's more atmospheric energy. The cold air coming in is colder,
and the warm air it's hitting is warmer and wetter.
Dang.
That's what it is. That's the only difference. And right now, to assess the possibility of this risk, what they ought to be doing more of in this country, and they do it some. There's some very good weather reports across the Midwest, and in fact, in Oklahoma City, a couple of stations have really good weather reports, is they need to keep telling us exactly where jet stream is, because the farther east it moves and the farther south, the greater the danger to the people who are on the front border of it, because that's where the action is going to take place, if there is going to be action. Now, right now, there's a reasonably strong front across the middle of the country, but there's not enough humidity to the east of it to build up into any big supercells. There's another storm system pushing in from the Pacific Northwest, but right now the jet stream comes down, comes across Southern California, loops down across North Texas, thank God, and it's bringing them a little rain, and then moves sharply up across the spine of the Midwest through the Dakotas, leaving the whole eastern half of the country pretty much alone. So unless it is pushed down again, they'll have a more peaceful end of June, hopefully. And we just have to hope and pray that condition stays the way it is. And it should move north now. It's getting warmer in the north, and that usually is what draws the jet stream north in the spring. So we should be fine.
We should be.
Should be, but these days you just don't know.
You don't know. Mark in New York? Hey, Mark, thanks for calling.
Hi, Willie, and George, and I got some more bizarre for you. And it was funny when Whitley was talking about that story about that little guy. When he talked about it, I knew that that person was me. It was a probable self that my unconscious mind created, because when I saw the woman on TV talking about the alien on her bed, I knew what she was going to say before she said it, and it took me 6 months to realize that that was me out of my body and projecting to Whitley's cabin, because I had met Whitley at a UFO conference in 1990 down in North Haven, Connecticut. So the little guy that broke the spokes on the bike, I had an encounter with my nephew back in 1974 when he was only 3 years old. He put his arm out through the into a bicycle as it went past with this big guy on it, and I was trying to break the spokes.
Huh. Well, Whitley, maybe, huh?
Well, I don't know, because I've never seen a spirit smoke, and this guy smoked a lot, so I don't think so.
And wait, what did he do with those cigarette butts? Did he just toss them all over the place?
No, he left them in piles. And, you know, if this was now, not then, we could have gotten them DNA tested.
Yes, that's
but
a good point.
Unfortunately, in the early 90s, that was a very complicated, difficult, expensive process, and it was not accessible. We didn't have access to it. But he did smoke. He smoked ordinary cigarettes and a lot of them.
I've got a minute left. I want to get your quick reaction to Andy Jacobson's work on Area 51 and her theory that it was the Soviet Union that bounced something down in Roswell. What'd you think?
All I can say is this. First of all, she's been outed, and it's all over the Internet. You can get an excellent story about it on unknowncountry.com right now. Her so-called anonymous source for this turns out to be a person who was in a pretty innocuous position and not really in a direct position to know. I personally knew General Arthur Exon, who was in a position to know, who was at Wright Field, who received the debris and who was on top of this from the very beginning. And General Exon said, and I quote, "Everyone from Truman on down knew that what we had found was not of this world within 24 hours of our finding it."
What an incredible quote. Whitley, thank you so much. We have hit the top of the hour. Whitley Strieber, his website, unknowncountry.com. Hey, you know, with this weather situation, wait a minute, as we say in Missouri, it'll change. I'll be back in a moment as we talk about the cosmic Internet on Coast to Coast AM.